Our second reading this morning is a short excerpt from One World at a Time, remembering Henry David Thoreau on the 150th anniversary of his funeral. These are words by Reverend Jenny Rankin, who served this church well and nobly for many years. Henry David Thoreau was about 3 months old when his family carried him to this church. The date was October 1817. He was carried up here to the pulpit area, where he lay in the arms of Reverend Ezra Ripley, who was the minister then. Reverend Ripley was just about to start his 40th year as minister here, a tenure that would last 63 years in all. Ezra Ripley conducted the christening ceremony for baby Thoreau that day. It would be almost 45 years later that his family and friends returned to this church for his funeral, gathering to give thanks and to celebrate his life. More than 300 of the town's 400 children joined the procession of the townspeople that accompanied Thoreau's casket to the burial ground at the foot of Bedford Street. For a man who is generally thought to have received little recognition in his lifetime, Thoreau got a remarkable amount of attention in death. When Ralph Waldo Emerson stood at this pulpit the afternoon of May 9th, 1862, to deliver his lengthy eulogy for Henry David Thoreau, he knew that he was commenting on a life that was little understood even when it was over. At age 44, Henry David Thoreau died neither remarkably young nor remarkably old for his time period. What is clear from Emerson's eulogy is that everyone around Henry assumed that they would have more time with him. They assumed his writing and thinking would go on just as his long daily walks would continue. They assumed that they would talk to him again or pass him on the street. A fixture in the town of Concord, Henry David Thoreau caused few townspeople to think much about him until he was gone. The solemn tolling of the bell that now sits out on the church green in front of this very meeting house greeted the mourners that afternoon, the very bell that Thoreau had rung himself to draw attention to Emerson's anti-slavery speech at the courthouse some years earlier. 44 times the bell tolled, once for every year of Henry's life. Reverend Grindle Reynolds, the minister of this church, read some verses from the Bible that day, and the choir sang a hymn written for the occasion by Ellery Channing, one of Thoreau's dearest friends. Then Ralph Waldo Emerson stood here and spoke at length about his friend. He spoke of what Thoreau's life might mean to the world now that he had died. "It was a pleasure and a privilege to walk with him," Emerson said. "He knew the country like a fox or a bird and passed through it as freely by paths of his own. He knew every track in the snow or on the ground and what creature had taken this path before him. One must submit abjectly to such a guide," Emerson said, "and the reward is great for doing so." Under his arm, he carried an old music book to press plants. In his pocket, his diary and pencil, a spyglass for birds, microscope, jackknife, and twine. He wore a straw hat, stout shoes, strong gray trousers to brave scrub oaks and bushes, and to climb a tree for a hawk's or a squirrel's nest. He waded into the pools for the water plants, and his strong legs were no insignificant part of his armor. His interest in the flower or the bird lay very deep in his mind, Emerson continued, and was connected with nature. And the meaning of nature was never attempted to be defined by him. His power of observation seemed to indicate additional senses. He saw as with a microscope, heard as with ear trumpet, and his memory was a photographic register of all he saw and heard. Having written many eulogies myself, I know what Emerson is doing. He is doing what any minister is called upon to do in a time of grief, which is simply to make sense of the awful present by squaring it with the past. Emerson is in grief himself that day as he talks about his friend. The sheer length of the eulogy and its kind, flowery tone tells me Emerson is raw inside, no matter how self-possessed he might have seemed to the congregation that day. Emerson will never talk to Thoreau again, nor will anyone. All the old arguments are forgotten, all the old spats are forgiven, all the little moments are remembered as more significant than they were when they happened. Henry David Thoreau is dead. His particular kind of genius is gone. Of course, what remains of him are his writings and what others will make of his life. No more will Thoreau tell his own story, but others will take up the telling. Some will want to make a saint of him, and others will declare him a kook. All will agree there was something intriguing and compelling in this man and how he lived. He will be much better known after he has died than he would ever be known in his lifetime. And this is often how it goes. We so often do not know what we have until it is gone. The country knows not yet, nor in the least part, how great a son it has lost, Emerson said that May afternoon in 1862. It seems an injury that he should leave in the midst of his broken task, which none else can finish, a kind of indignity to so noble a soul that he should not depart out of nature before he has been really shown to his peers for what he is. But he, at least, is content. His soul was made for the noblest society. He had, in a short life, exhausted the capabilities of this world. Wherever there is knowledge, wherever there is virtue, wherever there is beauty, he will find a home. The oddest part of that final day of Thoreau's earthly journey does not escape me, though. It might be a fitting bookend that Henry David Thoreau was buried out of the very church that he was christened in. But it would be a mistake to think that he found much of a home here during his life. Raised by a religious mother and religious aunts, Thoreau was well acquainted with the Christianity of his day. He knew his Bible, he knew the prayers, he knew the ministers of this church, and he surely knew the meeting house itself. Yet, Thoreau kept himself apart from the congregation, and the congregation likely kept itself apart from him. This man, who was much more content hearing the Concord church bell ring from afar than to follow its sounds to a worship service, might have found himself quite surprised to be back in the place for his own funeral. this mystical thinker who was more at home in the Cathedral of Trees than any hard-pewed sanctuary, might have wondered why these people were making such a fuss over him now. But to think of Thoreau as non-religious or even anti-religious would be a mistake. For him, religion would always be much larger than any particular church. Emerson recognizes this too when he says in the eulogy, "Henry was sincerity itself and might fortify the convictions of prophets in the ethereal laws by his holy living." A truth speaker, he, capable of the most deep and strict conversations, a physician to the wounds of any soul, a friend knowing not only the secret of friendship, but almost worshipped by those few persons who resorted to him as their confessor and prophet, and knew the deep value of his great mind and generous heart. He thought that without religion or devotion of some kind, nothing great was ever accomplished. And he thought that the bigoted sectarian had better bear this in mind. The greatest gift Henry David Thoreau has given Unitarian Universalism is his insistence that God was not confined to the church, nor confined to one religion over any other. The modern-day expression of our faith is an institutionalized version of the transcendentalism both Emerson and Thoreau, among others, espoused. We combine Emerson's direct experience with God and project it out into Thoreau's natural world. The result is a religion much more concerned with justice in this world than salvation in the next. Our care of the earth and its creatures comes directly from Thoreau. Our insistence on a personal experience with the holy, however defined, comes largely from Thoreau's direct experience of the world around him. Even though he found it necessary to write the Concord town clerk to clarify that he was not a member of this congregation, we have taken up his way of being religious in the world. We have a lovely copy of the enlarged note there for all of you to see after the service. He was very kind to us, but very clear. And because he would not come to us, we have had to come to him, and we are so much richer for our journeying toward him. Just as First Parish in Concord claims Henry as its wayward son, so does Unitarian Universalism. So great a religious shift did Thoreau make in the faith that we love that we could not imagine our congregations without him. We Unitarian Universalists go to great lengths to listen to Henry David Thoreau. We try to understand what he meant. We try to act as he did. We try to see the world through his eyes and hear the world through his ears. In doing so, we make not a saint of him. Rather, we make a friend. For we too think that he died too young and too poorly understood, we too stand with Emerson trying to eulogize this friend that we have lost. Of Henry David Thoreau's funeral, Louisa May Alcott wrote in a letter, "It was a lovely day, clear and calm and spring-like. And as we all walked after Henry's coffin with its fall of flowers, carried by six of his townsmen who had grown up with him, it seemed as if nature wore her most benignant aspect to welcome her dutiful and loving son into his long sleep in her arms. As we entered the churchyard, birds were singing, early violets blooming in the grass, and the pines singing their softest lullaby. And there, between his father and his brother, we left him, feeling that though his life seemed too short, it would blossom and bear fruit for us long after he was gone, and that perhaps we should know a closer friendship now than ever while he lived. May we too strive to know this man through his words and through his actions, taking care not to make him a martyr or a saint, but a fellow traveler in this complex and beautiful world. Might we not gloss over the roughness or the injustice of the world, nor ignore its pleasures? And may we ever examine what we think and what we do, knowing our lives will be measured by our words and our deeds. So be it. Amen.